Blog Talk Radio.
A New Day for Al-Islam in America Radio is proud to present its weekly series called Meet the Members of the Muslim American Media Alliance. This alliance is made up of Muslim professionals, organizations, and businesses in the media industry with a collective mission to share information, network, and present the stories of Al-Islam and Muslims in America through resources in print, music, film, radio, video, and new media. And now, your host for the program, William Kareem.
Assalamu alaikum and welcome to another edition of Meet the Mama Members. That's the Muslim American Media Alliance. Yes, the Muslim American Media Alliance members are Muslim professionals, organizations, and businesses in the media industry with the collective mission to share information, network, and present the stories of Al-Islam and Muslims in America through resources in print, music, film, radio, video, and new media. And as you may know, as we are living in a time when the news is no longer just black and white, it is now colored with the particular opinion of pundits, politicians, and news organizations. And many times, Al-Islam and Muslim Americans have been ostracized and misrepresented without having an opportunity to respond or be considered. So here at the Muslim American Media Alliance, what we do, at this program, we give Muslims an opportunity to share their views, opinions, and to let you know what's going on with those Muslims in the American circumstance in other parts of the world. Today, we have a member with us named Nuri Amir, one of my personal friends that I've known for many, many years, and Allah has blessed him to continue in the work of promoting and being a Muslim here in the United States of America. And he's doing some very special things, and I'm going to bring on my brother, Nuri Amir. Assalamu alaikum, and welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum assalam. Sounds like birds of a feather, huh? How are you, my
Sheikh
beloved
Mufti?
Brother?
Your word. What's going on, Sheikh Mufti?
Alhamdulillah, big Mufti, Sheikh. So how are you today, Dick?
Oh, praise is due to Allah, brother. Thank you so very much for taking the time to come on the show and to be with us. I was really happy to find that you were doing some great things in media. You know that we go way back to New York City, Malcolm Shabazz, Nasheed, Temple Number 7.
And alhamdulillah.
Where we met and where we became Muslim. And here it is, you know, almost 30 years later, Allah blessed us to continue to be involved in the community, man, and that is a wonderful thing.
Has it been that long, Sheikh?
Wow. I didn't really want to tell people that it was over 30 years, man, but, yeah, we'll just stick with 30.
Alhamdulillah. Well, I'm really, really grateful and proud, and I feel blessed to be here with you. We really love what you're doing with Mama and working with the Muslims around the country, and we thank you for your good work, brother. Thank you, and may Allah continue to bless you to do what you're doing.
Well, you know, I'm saying that. Listen, Allah is blessing us, man. And by you being on the program to share some of the things that you're doing in what's Halal Getaways, which is a very interesting work. I haven't had an opportunity to actually interview someone who is working in this field of media and also the field of travel. So what can you tell us about Halal Getaways?
Well, alhamdulillah, first let me say that Halal Getaway is a new project. We've been up and running about 3 months, and we've had a really, really great response. I guess some background information would be in order. A couple of months ago, I was talking with another web. I do web design. William Kareem and I go back many years, and we worked in the entertainment industry together, and we know each other from that venue, from that, I guess, experience. But what happened a couple of months ago, I was talking to another web designer or web design company. I saw a website that was designed by a company out of Hoboken, New Jersey, and the site was called HMAG. And I looked at the site, and I discovered that it was built on a WordPress platform, but it was a really, really extensive site, a social networking site, and I didn't know that WordPress had that capability. So what I did was I contacted the web design company, and I spoke with them, and I asked, you know, how long it took to build the site and what the cost was. And they said that it took them about over three months, and 3 to 6 months, I believe, and at a cost of about $50,000. And the reason I was interested in the site doing web design, we were looking to do that kind of work. And I realized that I didn't have $50,000 to build a website. But what I did have was resources. I knew people who were web designers. I knew people who were graphic artists. I knew people who were programmers, web developers working in private industry, working for the government, working in corporate America. So I didn't have $50,000 to invest in building a website, but I knew I had $50,000 worth of talent at my disposal. So what I did was I contacted some of the brothers that I knew, and most of the brothers that I contacted were Muslim, who are working in various avenues in web design and in internet technology. And I suggested that we all get together and we work on a project together. And that idea came from what Allah says in the Quran, that He loves those who work together as though they were a solid wall, as though they were a solid brick wall. So when I spoke to most of my friends, they all agreed, and about 6 or 7 of us got together, but we couldn't decide what project to do. So Sister Jamila, my wife, suggested at the same time, she had been reading some information online about how fast the Muslim travel industry was growing. So she suggested that we do a travel site. And I thought it was a good idea. I brought it to the brothers, and all of the brothers had other ideas, and we were talking about doing other things. So nobody thought that was a big enough idea for this group of talented people. So, but one brother, Bilal Shabazz, he agreed. He thought it was a great idea, and he said, "Well, okay, I'm with you." Another brother, Deshaun Reed, who's a good friend, who's the son of my good friend Anis Reed from East Orange, New Jersey, he came aboard, but he's in school, so he couldn't get away to work with us immediately. So what I did was I asked Bilal to come down and spend a couple of days with me in Atlanta, and what we did, Bilal, Sister Jamila, and I went into design mode on a Thursday night, and by Sunday we had built Halal Getaway. And to demonstrate how monumental that was, if I had done that by myself, it would have probably taken me a year. But working together, I do web design. Brother Bilal does coding. He writes JavaScript and those background PHP, those background codes that make websites work and function. And Sister Jamila does content, which is basically putting the information that you see, that the public sees, on the website. So by the end of the weekend, we had a website. Bilal left that Monday morning, and Halal Getaway, and that's H-A-L-A-L-G-E-T-A-W-A-Y.com, was on the internet. And that's how that came about. And we also built, Sister Jamila built us a Facebook page for Halal Getaway as part of our marketing strategy. She put us together. Okay, Kareem?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. So what, after she built the Facebook page, she built us a Twitter page and a LinkedIn page. And basically what happened, the response we started getting from people on Facebook and on Twitter was overwhelming. The comments basically were that this is something that's been needed for a long time. This is something that the Muslims have needed. And let me just say this. The reason that we did the site was because of research that we had seen. There's an organization called Dinar Standard. It's a U.S.-based marketing research and advisory firm focused on Muslim markets. And it had, and they partnered with an organization called Crescent Rating, who do halal-friendly travel. And they did a study, and the study, based on Muslim tourist consumers, estimates that the global Muslim tourism market in 2011 was $126 billion in outbound expenditure, which means Muslims traveling. And the big part of this, that is not including core religious travel for Hajj and Umrah. This is just leisure travel, leisure and business travel for Muslims outside of Hajj and Umrah. That constitutes 12% of the total global, actually 12.3% of the total global outbound tourism expenditure in 2011. Okay? And that number is expected to grow up to around 13.5% by 2012, which will make the Muslim travel market the largest travel market in the world. Right now, we're only second behind the Germans who travel, as a group, the Germans do more travel than anybody else in the world. The Muslims are only behind the Germans in terms of total travel expenditure. So if we're going to be the biggest part of the Muslim travel market, and there's no one who's putting together marketing and ad campaigns for Muslim travelers, then we saw that this was a niche that we could take advantage of. And what happened is yeah, go ahead, bro.
Yeah, I was just looking at the site just now on Facebook, and I see that you have a lot of people that have basically who have looked at your site, and I also see that you have something that says that if you run a business in the hospitality, food, and travel industries, and you provide halal products and services, please visit our website. Oh, that's for the other thing that we want to talk about. Let's not talk about that yet. We're going to bring that up about halal ads. We'll bring that up a little bit more in the program. But what I wanted to do at this point was to bring in. You say you have Sister Jamila. This is your wife, and she's on the line with us. Let's bring her in to the conversation. Assalamu alaikum, Sister Jamila.
Assalamu alaikum. How are you, brother?
Alhamdulillah, and thank you so very much for being part of this show and with Nuri. What can you tell us about halal industries and the halal getaways and the content that you produce?
Yes, certainly. Here in Australia, we had a number of Muslims who were saying that one of the problems they had when they went on holiday was that they could never be sure that where they went, they would find an environment that was halal or at least Muslim-friendly that they could feel comfortable holidaying in. And we have searched the internet trying to find not just good locations or nice locations, but locations where and destinations where people who or Muslims who do travel to these locations can perhaps find areas where sisters don't have to wear hijab. Maybe there's separate swimming facilities for the sisters, or all the facilities are halal, so that the sisters and the brothers, of course, the families can eat halal food in an environment where there's no alcohol. So we've spent a lot of time locating all those sort of destinations, and we're hoping that we can partner with those businesses to help promote what they are offering to the Muslim community worldwide. We're also looking for content from different travelers, Muslim travelers, who have found their own halal or Muslim-friendly service providers and who can give us some reviews and feedback on those businesses. Because not only are we interested in helping the Muslim traveler, we're also very much interested in promoting Muslim businesses as well, and also non-Muslim businesses who are beginning to provide suitable facilities, suitable
services.
Exactly, or at least Muslim-friendly services to the communities as well. Because, with this increase in traveling, a lot of the countries of the world, for example, New Zealand, Queensland in Australia, Japan, Vietnam, many countries in the world are starting to increase the amount of facilities that they have available to Muslims. And as a gesture of appreciation and also to support what they're trying to do to help the Muslim community, we would also like to partner with them and assist them in their ventures to help the Muslims who are traveling.
Yes. I just wanted everyone to know and that while you are hearing the unique accent of Brother Nuri Amir's wife on Sister Jamila. Sister Jamila, tell them where you're calling from.
I'm actually English born in Australia. I've lived in Australia all my life, so I have an Australian accent, I presume.
She's calling from Melbourne. She's calling from Melbourne, Australia.
That definitely gives it an international. And since we're talking about that, are there many Muslims that are in Australia, and are there halal getaways in Australia?
I'm sorry, could you repeat the question? I think we have a fairly poor line at the moment.
I'm sorry. Is that to say that are there many Muslims in Australia, and are there halal places or halal getaways in Australia?
Okay, yes. The Australian population there's a very large population of Muslims living in Australia. Australia, though, is unique because all of our population live, and not just Muslim population, but our general population live around our capital cities in each of our states. So therefore, for example, here in Melbourne, we have about 350,000 Muslims, and we're all concentrated into a small area, which means that we have a lot of halal facilities, particularly in the areas that the Muslims are living in, which are very often not utilized as much as they should be because there are so many of them. And we would like to help those businesses to become known not just to the Muslim population here in Melbourne, but also to visitors that come here. And this situation is similar in Sydney and in Brisbane. And Brisbane last year did a very interesting thing for Muslims during Ramadan. They actually had the whole state promoted Brisbane as a destination for Muslims to celebrate Ramadan and Eid by having facilities prepared for them that were specifically suited to, you know, to having the having all the, you know, just a very nice Ramadan up there for fasting, and then for coming together for iftars in the afternoon, in the evenings, and they promoted that worldwide. So Australia is doing its best to, well, at least parts of Australia have got some very good facilities available for Muslims to attend, to visit.
Yes. Now, Nuri, how do you while we were speaking and talking, we were talking about other halal getaways. How do you actually get the places for halal getaways? How do these recommendations for these places to go that are halal for Muslims to travel? How do you actually get those recommendations?
Well, generally, Kareem, what we do is, well, when we first started the site, we solicited Muslims on Facebook and on Twitter to tell us their stories, to give us their feedback on good places for Muslims to go, because as Sister Jamila said, the need was for Muslims to have places that they could go that would be Muslim-friendly, that would have halal food. When Muslims travel, they would prefer to travel on airlines that have halal food. They want to go to a place where some Muslims don't listen to music and don't want to hear a lot of loud music. The sisters want to swim, but they don't want to swim around men. So there needs to be some sort of segregated facility for sisters that want to enjoy the facilities without having to wear hijab. And they can do that with other sisters. So what we do, where most of our recommendations come from, are the people who visit Halal Getaway. And we would like to reach out to your audience and ask them to visit Halal Getaway. If they have a story, we're looking for people to write stories and to give us stories about good travel destinations that they've been to that have been Muslim-friendly, that have not served alcohol, that have had halal food. But that's where most of our content comes from, and from Muslim businesses and organizations who are who have halal products or Muslim-friendly services that want to advertise or promote their products and services. We also get our locations from those places, and we also do a lot of research. We troll the internet. We get a Sheikh Google. That's what we call him. Sheikh Google can answer most questions.
Yes,
Sheikh Google can answer most questions regarding anything that you're trying to do.
Yes, very true. But let me ask you this. You know, one problem that I have basically found in travel is the alcohol, the selling of alcoholic beverage, man. That you know, once you get into the alcoholic beverage thing, there's a lot of promotion about, you know, drinking, you know, and people think that, well, I won't say that people think, but, you know, think that when you travel, people have a tendency to drink more.
I have a very funny story about that.
Okay.
We actually, and Sister Jamila can probably jump in on this. We have a restaurant in Melbourne who wanted Halal Getaway to do some promotion for them, and the restaurant is called Secret Recipe. There's a plug for you guys. The restaurant is called Secret Recipe. It's in Melbourne, Australia, and it's halal, and they don't serve alcohol, but they're part of a chain, and the chain, some of the restaurants in the chain serve alcohol. So we were faced with a dilemma at that point with determining now, do we want to promote this one restaurant that does have a halal product that is a part of a chain where if someone went to one Secret Recipe restaurant, there would be no alcohol, but if they went to another, there would be alcohol. So this was a dilemma, and one of the things that we're learning in terms of branding, the word branding, where the internet and where marketing in general are concerned, branding, the best way to describe what branding is it's your reputation. When you're talking about branding your product or your name or yourself or whatever the case may be, you're talking about how are people perceiving you as a brand? What is your reputation? And we as Halal Getaway, we want our brand to be completely halal. So we can't promote alcohol or anything that is haram in any way. But by the same token, at this restaurant, they don't sell any alcohol. So what we've agreed to do is we will promote this one restaurant, and we will make it known that we only promote this Secret Recipe restaurant.
Right, the one restaurant in the chain.
Yeah, the one restaurant that is halal, completely halal, that does not sell alcohol. And there are others in the chain that are completely halal, and we will promote those, but we will not promote any of those that sell alcohol.
We live in the American circumstance as we do. You know, many times we might not be able to find places that are completely halal, but, you know, Imam W.D. Muhammad has always, you know, told us. I remember one of the stories Imam W.D. Muhammad said that he was invited to, I don't know whether it was an affair, someone's home that was hosting him or some other place, but there was something on the plate and that was not halal. And, you know, rather than, you know, say, yo, I don't eat this here, what this is for, or whatever, you know, he just didn't eat it. You know, he didn't say anything about it, but he just never touched it. And I know many a times in American circumstance, you know, we may go to a restaurant that does serve alcohol, but the whole idea is, even though you might be in a place like that, you don't have to order the alcoholic drink, you know what I mean? Because that's just basically the dilemma that we have here in America, and that's how we've learned how to make those kinds of adjustments. So when you say completely halal, I just want people to understand the idea of what you're talking about as far as halal getaways, that sometimes it might not be 100% completely halal. Something might be in there, but they are sensitive to Muslim practices and therefore will accommodate them as best as possible. Is that what we're talking about?
Well, one of the things that you bring up a very, very, very good point, especially for Muslims, not just living in America, but Muslims living in the West, period. We've grown up and we've become accustomed to dealing with circumstances like you just described, where we'll go to a restaurant that may have halal food, or there may be something that on the menu that we can have, but the restaurant may sell alcohol. That happens with me a lot, where I'll have fish. I'll have some sort of fish dish. But what we've decided to do at Halal Getaway, and as you said, we'll talk about Halal Ad in a moment, but what we've decided to do is in our promotion, we will only promote restaurants and facilities that have halal, as far as food is concerned, and as far as travel, we will only promote places that are completely halal. Now, that limits the amount of money that we can make, because if we were willing to promote anything and everything that came our way, then we would probably make a lot more money. But what we've decided to do is that we're looking at a market that, as I stated at the beginning of the program, is $126 billion. So there's enough money in halal, just completely halal, for us, I think, to make a good living. So we've made the decision as a part of our brand mission statement that we will only promote and market brands that are completely halal. Now, that is what we've chosen to do. What others do, that's between them, that's between them, Allah, and their conscience. But that's what we've chosen to do. And as I said, the response has been really, really great here in America and internationally.
Now, that's very interesting. That's very, very interesting that is the concept. Well, we're halfway through the show already. And what we want to do, Nuri, is transition over into some of the other things that you are doing as far as halal ads. And at this point, let me read what you have on your Facebook page regarding halal getaway. You say, if you run a business in the hospitality, food, or travel industries, and you provide halal products and services, please visit our website, halalad.com, and allow us to use banner ads on our halal ad server, obligation-free discussions, end quote. and that's halal, halal, and think halal, buy halal, live halal. What would you like to tell us about that?
Well, alhamdulillah, first of all, Kareem, thank you for being so, what's the word I'm looking for, eloquent in the way that you say things. You are definitely a poet, brother. You still got it, okay?
Thank you, sir. Appreciate it.
Alhamdulillah. One of the things that I'll say is that when we first started Halal Getaway, one of the things that we encountered, or one of the things that we did, is we had Google AdSense on our website selling it as a way of making money. You make money on the internet from selling ads, people clicking on ads. That's basically how you make money. And we had Google AdSense, which was paying us, and we were making money. But here's the thing. The ads that were coming up were not all Muslim-friendly. Even though we were able to, you know, you can block certain ads that we didn't have any liquor ads or no cigarette ads or no condom ads or anything like that. We didn't have any ads that would be offensive to Muslims. But even some of the ads, say for hotels or something, they would have pictures of women in bikinis and that kind of thing. And some of the people that were visiting our site were commenting on this. So what we found, and we went looking for Muslim advertising. And what we found is that there really is none. There are no companies out there that basically cater to a Muslim target market audience. So what we did is we investigated, and as I said, Bilal Shabazz, he's a brilliant young brother from South Carolina who lives in Atlanta. He told us about a way that he sets up servers and networks and that kind of thing, and he set us up an ad server, and we put the ad server on online, and we started talking with graphic artists. We have a young brother named Deshaun Reed who does graphic design. We also have some other companies that do banners and that kind of thing. So what we basically did is we started an advertising company for Muslim businesses, and this is important. We have our own ad server, so an ad server is basically a server that hosts ads that serves them up to any website that we have the IP address for. We give them the code. They put it in their website, just like Google, just like Facebook, just like any of the other companies that are big in advertising online. So now we have a Muslim, completely halal ad server, and we have found that the Muslims really need it, because so many Muslims are in business, and a lot of Muslims are not even taking advantage of the fact that they're in business, and the internet is an inexpensive way for them to market their business. And anybody, there's a reason that companies like Nabisco and Birdseye and Kodak and Toyota and GMC spend so much of their budgets on advertising, because if nobody knows that you're there, nobody can come. They can't find you. They can't come buy from your business. So
right.
We created halalad.com, and that's halalad, halalad.com. And
right.
If you go there, and the site is, we're still putting the site together, but the backbone or the actual structure is in place. We can create ads for any Muslim business, and that's how that came about. Because and it's basically what we're doing is we're just responding to the needs that we're seeing Muslims have.
Yes. Sister Jamila, even though you're in another part of the world as being the content producer, what kinds of challenges do you have? And I'm asking you this as someone who's involved in media what kind of challenges and what kind of advantages and contributions do you see in that you're making by participating in an endeavor like this? I mean, I know that you're supporting your husband, but also what are the other contributions that you can see with your involvement?
Yeah, I think the important, when it comes to marketing and internet marketing now, content is really the way that different groups, businesses, organizations can market their products. I've been writing now on the line for about 3 years through my own company, Lady Freelancer, and what we have discovered is that particularly attracting people to the website, that it's the content that goes onto the website which makes the website an attractive place for customers, potential customers to come, and then for them to become the clients and the customers of the businesses and the services that we're supporting and we're promoting. So my unique, I suppose, contribution over here is that I can write online, I can be able to, I can continue on with the Facebook and Twitter and LinkedIn social media posts, which is making our products and services known to the world, but also it's promoting those companies that do decide to choose to go with, to put their ads on our server. We can then help market them. We can consult, we can become consultants for them, especially for new businesses, perhaps small Muslim businesses who don't have a web presence. We can provide everything they need to promote themselves and their and their services and products. One thing I would like to say is that Sound Vision put out an article not so long ago about the importance of supporting halal. One of the problems for the Muslim community is that there is, well, for those brothers and sisters who are trying to produce halal products and sell halal products, be it in the hospitality, the food, or the travel industry, one of the problems they're facing is that sometimes it's more convenient for Muslims to go down to the local supermarket or maybe to choose to go to any hotel or any destination. Because and the problem for that, for those companies that are trying to do everything halal, is that because they're not being supported, they often go out of business. And as Brother Nouri said at the beginning, one of the important things as an ummah that we do have to do is to support each other, to be one with each other. We've chosen to do that with Halal Getaway and with what we're doing with Halal Ads and with the team of us working together. But on the broader scale, it is just so important that the Muslim ummah around the world supports each other and supports each other's businesses. And I see that that is... that the content that we put onto our Halal Getaway and associated sites, and also the adverts that we're able to produce and use to support these businesses, is a way that we can help the ummah become strong and self-sufficient, which I think in today's age where so many economies around the world are struggling, as we can help each other to survive, we're helping each other as brothers and sisters in Islam as well.
Alhamdulillah, that was very well said. Well, I just want you to know that this is why this radio program, Meet the Mama members, the members of the Muslim American Media Alliance, wind up being important. It is accomplishing the goal of basically putting some content behind the picture that you might see on the Muslim American Media Alliance page. It is with the assistance of our creative director, Touré Muhammad, who helps to create the Facebook page and also to maintain it, with his assistance that we have been able to bring on the likes of Rufus and Jenny Triplett of Dawah International, Shelly Shabazz, Dion Robinson, Omar Regan, actor-comedian, Omar Regan, Dion Robinson, he's a media specialist. He does something called he's going into, it's really video right now, but it's like he's creating a video series called Aaliyah. And also Amir Muhammad, who's right down there in Atlanta with you, who did a documentary called Ibana, and Ron Foster Sharif, a video and photo journalist who works with Muslim Journal, and Imam author Michael Sahir, who wrote the book, Elijah Muhammad, The Man Behind the Men. And also yourselves, you know, Nuri Amir and Sister Jamila Amir, who are working on this product called Halal Getaways, and also sponsoring Halal ads. Just by looking at the picture that you might see on a Facebook page, or just by looking at the site itself, members don't know exactly what's going on with these people, but there's a lot going on, and that's why we have this program, so that the members have an opportunity to express themselves and to let people know that there's a lot going on with Muslims here in the wilderness of North America, that we're not just sitting around doing anything, but there's active involvement, man, all over the place.
I saw it. Can I say something?
Please, go ahead.
First, I haven't heard that in a long time. Lost in the wilderness of North America.
That's right.
And the other thing that I wanted to say is that I not only agree with what you just said, but I wasn't aware of some of the things that were going on when you're working. Sometimes you may feel that you're working in a vacuum, that you're the only one out there doing it. And I'm really grateful to you, Kareem, and to A New Day in Al-Islam in America for promoting the different members of MAMA and Muslims in general who are doing things in business and that kind of thing, and in media and in the arts and entertainment. Because if we don't, if there's no, the other thing that I wanted to say is that we want at Halal Ad, we want to promote you guys too. We want to help you with an ad campaign of some sort to make people more aware of what's going on with the radio show with you, Kareem, and you mentioned Torre Muhammad. I believe he's working with Taqwa Productions out of Atlanta, and
that's
we
right.
just. Yeah, well, we just signed an agreement with Brother Hassan Shakir of Taqwa Productions, and Torre is one of on the board with Taqwa, I believe, and works with them.
That's right.
We've just made an agreement where they're going to be doing commercials. They'll be shooting the video commercials that we'll be using on Halal Ad. And we would like to say that, please, any Muslim business, any Muslim organization, anyone in media, anyone that is listening to this program, please contact us. Let's talk. Let's see how we can work together, because Allah loves the Muslims when they work together as if they were a solid wall. So let's work together. Let's talk about what we can bring to the table, what you bring to the table. And one other thing that I want to say is that when dealing with Muslims, we must respect each other's talents and abilities and be willing to pay for them, because that's one of the things that other communities do. That they won't before they go outside their community, if they need a carpenter, they'll go see if there's a carpenter in their community and they'll hire him. Now, he may be, as Sister Jamila said, with some of the halal businesses, they have trouble staying in business because they don't get the support. And we are a $126 billion industry in travel alone. If that's what we're doing in travel, imagine how much money the Muslims around the world are spending. If we just support our own businesses, we will enrich the lives of Muslims and thereby make our own lives better. So let's work together, you know?
Yes, and the other part that we really have to understand is, yeah, we have to be willing to spend money, but there was something that Imam W.D. Muhammad had tried to definitely work with us on, which was the barter system, to get us to barter with each other. And
that's basically
what we're doing right now. We're basically supporting each other with whatever talents we have. It was, you know, in listening to some of the things that you were saying about the people that you're working with, they came to the table to work together, everybody donating their talents for the good of the whole, And inshallah, someplace on down the line, you know, money will be generated and created. But you first have to be able to have a working platform. You've got to have a working platform in order to generate the money. You know, like you said, Curry, which I thought was very interesting, if you had done this project by yourself, it would have probably taken you 3 years. But because you was able to find people who have the various talents, you would be able to put it together in 3 days.
Yeah, and that's the truth, Ak. That is the absolute truth. And the other thing with what you were just saying about the barter, when I say we have to be willing to pay for each other's services, it's not just in money. I'm not just talking about paper money, fiat currency. What I'm talking about is we have to be willing to give something for a service. In other words,
right.
I would love to barter with anyone, any Muslim business in terms of services, in terms of whatever they bring to the table. We can talk about it, and we can work something out where we can help you with your advertising. We can help you get your banners done, get you online. We can help you do your website, and it doesn't necessarily have to be a cash payment. If it's services, products, whatever the case may be, that's how we're going to grow stronger.
That's a good point.
That's something that, Aki, the time is perfect for this kind of conversation. For the things we're discussing, the timing is perfect because the world economic system is in deep trouble. And one of the things that I think we're going to get back to see more people getting back to is bartering.
Yes. Well, yeah, they're doing it now. They're actually doing it now. When you talk about a place like eBay and when you talk about Amazon.com, you know, people are taking the products that they have used, things that they've used, or little things that they're making, and they have little bartering systems that they do, and they send it all over the world. I know because in doing some of the things as far as mailing, I've seen people supporting themselves by going on places like eBay, Amazon, and selling used products, used books, used CDs, used clothing, and little trinkets that they might make, and they're actually able to support themselves. I know someone who's doing big business. They're here in the United States, but they do a big business in Japan by sending product over there. I mean, this guy comes down to the post office with hundreds of packages to mail to Japan, you know, because of the business that he's doing online. You know, we're almost 10 minutes out of the program, but there's a couple of things that I really have to mention, and that is some of our upcoming programs, Muslim American Media Alliance. I'd like to say that, you know, we have just reached our 100th member, and congratulations to Amir Muhammad out of Washington, D.C., who has a website called In the Name of Allah, InTheNameOfAllah.org. That wasn't Amir. That's Bilal Muhammad who has that. But we also have Misunderstood, whose name is Kavasha Shannon. She's also part of the Muslim American Media Alliance. She'll be coming on in the future. But next week, we're going to have the editor of a very historic Muslim magazine called Aziza Magazine. And Aziza Magazine has been in business for some time. She's one of the first Muslim magazines that are done here in the wilderness of North America, brother. And she's going to be our guest next week. But also, you know, right now we're talking about Facebook, but one of the objectives of the Muslim American Media Alliance for the year, as being the president of the Muslim American Media Alliance, I am promoting that Muslim American Media Alliance members become a part of the Ummah One social networking site called Ummah One. Have you heard of that social networking site, brother?
No, I have not. I have not.
Let me tell you that one.
You're telling me about it. I'm
going to
check it out as we speak.
Yes, Ummah1.com. And also, youareacreator.com. That's another social networking site that we have. Yes, Facebook is a great social networking site, but we should also support the Muslim social networking sites. And two that are very big are Umar One. Umar One.
Okay, spell Umar One. Spell Umar One, please.
Yes, it's U M M A H with the letter one. Umar1.com. If you go there, you'll be able to get onto the social networking site. And then the other site is You Are a Creator. That's YOURA, and then spell out creator, CREATOR. YOURACreator.com. And that's another Muslim social networking site. And while we are on Facebook, we need to be on those Muslim social networking sites. Those are the halal.
I'm on Umar One right now. Yeah,
yeah.
I'm on United Muslim Movement Association for Humanity.
Yes, yes, yes.
I'm on the site as we speak.
Excellent. So I'd like to thank you all for coming on, Noria. Listen, man, keep up the good work. And everyone, you can go to the Muslim American Media Alliance Facebook page, and you'll see Noori Amir up there. You'll see him. He's been up there for a while. Nuria Amir has been here. Next week we're going to have, like I said, we're going to have Taiba Taylor. We're also going to have Shahida. I'm going to tell you her name right now. Shahida Hazee, who did a book on the Hajj. Also, we were trying to get Sean Ali Abdul Sharif, also known as DJ Mecca. We still have to get him on in the future. And also, Misunderstood will be there. We're also going to get Mukhtar Muhammad of Famico Publishing, right? Famico Publishing Company. He's going to be coming up in the future. So we have a lot of great guests that are coming up on this website. And these are Muslim Americans that are involved in media and other social networking ideas. So we thank you, brother. I'd like you, some last words for you and Sister Jamila.
Well, go ahead, Jamila. What would you like to say?
I'll leave it for you to close if you like, inshallah.
Well, alhamdulillah. I guess the most important thing, as we were saying earlier, is for us to work together. And we invite everyone who's listening to the show. Go on Halal Getaway. Tell us about your experiences. Tell us what you would like to see. If you see that we're doing something that you don't like or you're not pleased with, please let us know that as well. We want to improve. We want to continuously get better. And please go to Halal Ad. As I said, the site is in progress, but the structure is in place. We are ready to create advertising for Muslim businesses and non-Muslim businesses. Also, we build websites. We're a website design company. If you have a website and if you'd like us to do a review of it and maybe do an update or an upgrade, we also do that. But we're looking forward to working with anybody and everybody who wants to do good. And one of the things that Imam Muhammad taught us is that we should be excellent in whatever we do, and we should strive for excellence, and that's what we're doing. We don't want to just give lip service. We want to get out there, and we want to do it. And one last thing I would like to say is that education is important. It's one thing to have a desire to do something, to make or build something, but you have to learn how to do it. And a few years ago, I resigned from a very good position in Washington, D.C., to go back to school to learn web design, because I wanted to do this. I knew that this was the future, in order to do this, I had to get educated. Now, I went to school online. I didn't go to a traditional college. So, and if anyone is interested in web design and I can help them, feel free to contact me with that for that as well. You can contact me at Noori_Amir@yahoo.com.
Okay, so listen, we thank you so very much, Noori Amir, my brother. from back in the day, and may Allah continue to bless you with good work, man. You and Sister Jamila. You and Sister Jamila.
Do you remember the propagators before of that my wedding back in 1983, man? That's, we go back like Cadillac seats, bruh.
And that's a story for another time. Thank you so very much, Brother Nori and Sister Jamila Amir. We appreciate you participating, and may Allah continue to bless you in the future. Assalamu alaikum.
Ameen. Ameen. Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you, Ak.
Alhamdulillah. So you've been listening. Muslim American Media Alliance's program called Meet the Mama Members. And Meet the Mama Members come on every week with guests that are part of our association or our alliance called Muslim American Media Alliance. And what we do is we have conversations. These conversations are important because although you might see the picture on Facebook, what is the person doing and what is the person about? And we have found that people who are part of our association are not just pictures of people just being there or just being your friend, but they are people that are actually involved in doing things. So we have an opportunity to talk to them, to give you, the listener, some information about what's going on with them, and inshallah, it will help you to understand a little bit more about some of Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum. It is now 1:02, and I'd like to welcome you to the second part of this program. And this here is what we're going to do for the next hour. We're going to have a conversation with another friend, a historical friend of mine, whose name is Clyde Wilder. And Clyde is a famous dancer who has danced for a long time. Actually, at one time in my life, I was dancing at one time. I used to dance, and in the process of being a dancer, what I did was I got into other things while Clyde continued to be a dancer. He's developed some very in-depth ideas, and what we want to do is we're going to speak with him, and we're just waiting on him to call in. But I will say that I can probably give you some information on him. Once I pull it up, but I'll say that this is Black History Month, and because this is Black History Month, that's what I wanted to do, was to bring you some more information about Black history. And I'm basically calling this Footprint, this part of the program, I'm calling it Footprint. And I'm calling it Footprints because there are many who have made a contribution in historical circumstance. We know about the Sojourner Truths and the earlier pioneers of African-American history, but there are those who are making historical contributions today. As a matter of fact, the work that all of us are doing will become part of the historical circumstance. And the question becomes, what are we going to do to make our contribution to history? And I'm sure that many people, the people that are now part of our historical circumstance here in America, some of the first slaves that were involved, I'm sure that people like Sojourner Truth, Sojourner Truth wasn't doing what she did so that she could become famous in history. She wasn't doing that. She had a desire to help her people. That's what she was doing. When you talk about Frederick Douglass, you think Frederick Douglass was making speeches so that he could get some recognition? Frederick Douglass was making his speeches and speaking on an issue of the day. And even though he was born a slave, he found ways in his difficult circumstances he found ways in his difficult circumstances to actually be make a difference in the time that he lived in. And that is the responsibility now that we have today. The question becomes, what are we going to do to become part of the historical circumstance? What are we going to do to aid and assist the people today? What are we going to do to make a contribution to the culture? What are we going to do? Well, like I said, the Nuri Amir, which was a person that I've known for over 30 years, we see that he is making a historical contribution. Not only is he continuing to be a Muslim, but he's done the things that he's doing with Halal Getaway. And we also have with us another person from my historical, from my history that I grew up with, named Clyde Wilder. And Clyde's contribution has been as a dancer, and he has made a significant contribution to the culture. And I'm going to bring on our brother, Clyde Wilder. What's going on, brother, and welcome to the program. How are you this afternoon?
Okay, very well. Thank you. How are you, Bree? All right.
Good.
And the family.
Very
good. How's the family? Good, good.
Everybody's fine.
Good.
I wanted to tell people, you know, Clyde, I was saying that many a time, I know that the time that we came up, and of course, both of us came up in Harlem, and dance was quite popular when we were coming up. We not only the popular dances of doing the twist and other dances, but dance has always been a part of the African American history. I remember my mother doing the jitterbug and the swing. That on the weekends people would go out and they would dance. I remember one time I saw my mother and my aunt, and they were dancing in the living room, and I was so afraid that they were going to hurt each other because they were doing the swing. And, you know, when you do the swing, you got to hold on to each other and you got to do the circle. Brother, if they had let each other go, I mean, someone was going to get hurt, you know. So dance has always been a part of the African-American circumstances, both socially and historically. And you have continued to be a dancer from the time that we've grown up. I went into other things, but you stayed in dance. And the question that I have for you is, you know, just to give our people some kind of historical content, why did you stay in dance? What was so attractive about it that made you continue in it?
Well, I mean, dance has been our life, you know. It's part of our culture, and it's part of our energy and spirit. It's the thing that keeps you healthy. You know, we dance in so many situations and all over the world, and from Africa and all parts of the world that we've gone to. You know, dance has been for our physical, spiritual, and our mental health, and it's always been a part of our language, it's part of our culture, how you move, and you know, the things that you the interpretation, your self-expression, all of that comes through your dance. You know, and you communicate thoughts, and your creativity comes through the dance. So we have negated that, and now our health is at issue at this time. Now, you know, because we have left out the dance for part of our system. It's a part of the system that that keep us alive and keep us going, even through the worst times. You know, even during the Depression. You know, and even doing slavery, we use the dance, you know. This is the thing that kept us going spiritually. This is the thing that kept us going, even economically. You know, you talked about your parents going maybe at the Savoy Ballroom or, you know, and dancing the Lindy Hop or the swings, you know.
Yeah.
But there was a whole economic system that was based on our music and our dance as well that supported us. So, but that's why I've been doing it. I've been doing it personally because it's been economics, it's been spiritual development, it's been a business, it's been fun. I've been meeting incredible amount of people. I've been meeting people from all over the world who wants to learn this dance, who wants to study this dance, who wants to be a part of this dance because and even in your family, you know, when you talk about the Savoy Ballroom, you talk about all of those, you know, the dancing and the spirit of it, you know, they light up even to mention. If you talk to elder now about dance and swing, they will light up because it's so important, so relevant to their existence. It's the reason why we're still here. It's the reason why certain people were born during those times, you know, because they came and they socialized in that fashion, you know, dance, and it brought people together. It made people understand that we needed each other. We knew the balance and timing and trust of being able to touch out, reach out, and somebody reach your hand back, and you actually spend 3 minutes of movement with that person. You have to balance. You have to be willing to share. You have to be willing to, you know, be in balance with that person for 3 minutes of a record, you know, of a song, you know. So it's so many different aspects of that.
Well, Clyde, in coming up, you know, who were some of your teachers that, you know, in Harlem at that time? Where were some of the places that you actually went to participate in dance?
Well, I started doing traditional African dance. You know, at first I actually started in martial arts, and my dance developed out of my martial arts. And I went up to Lehman College and hooked up with Chuck Davis up there. You know, Chuck Davis was teaching up at Lehman College, and Chuck was generally traveling all over. But Bernadine Jennings, you know, were there, and you know, I took a lot of classes with her. You know, and then you know, I went up to City College, and you know, they had classes and workshops and all kinds of things there, and I went with up there with Jess Oliver, you know, and I went to Nigeria, you know, with City College and SUNY, you know, with those people, you know, had a interesting and wonderful time all through Nigeria, you know, and I also went to the Church of the Master on 118th Street, where
yes.
Chuck and the drummers, I mean, it was smoking in there, you know, with all the drumming and dancing that was happening in that area, you know. And, it was just full of so many different people who were interested in studying the African culture at that time. And then we had Menacing Townhouse, you know, where Chuck also taught there as well, you know. And that was a great institution, you know, for learning African dance and studying, you know. And that's what I did, you know. So eventually, you know, I developed, you know, my dance. And you know, I went to Nigeria, you know, in 77 with City College and SUNY, and we went to Ibadan, Esuka, Benin, Ile Ife, you know, at the different universities. And so, you know, we actually went to pick up $2 million worth of artifacts, you know, and to bring back the Africa House, you know. So, you know, so
right.
So it was wonderful, you know. But that was my inspiration.
Well, let me ask you. I remember Chuck Davis and what I remember about him was I don't remember exactly where we were at, but I remember the technique that he used. And when I walked into the place, what he did was he would everyone would be on one side of the gymnasium, and what he would do is he would do a dance move all the way across the gymnasium, and then there would be drummers, and he would do a dance move to the drum beat, stand on the other side, and then he would count in 5, 6, 7, 8, and then all the rest of the dancers would try to copy his move. Do you remember that?
Right.
That
was what he did. That's the experience. That's the experience. But that's, you know, that's basically how, you know, maybe a teacher would, you know, do it. You know, but, you know, through the African dance, you know, when I went to Nigeria and I came back, I started studying the African-American dances, you know, because when I went there, it was, and I said that in that way because, you know, my whole thing was to understand, you know, when I got there, this festival was so intense, you know, so I was looking at different African dance culture from each continent, each country, you know. You know, the Ivory Coast came, the Guinea came, everybody came. This was a festival like the Olympics. So
right.
When I came back in 77, I was ready to study our traditional African-American dance. And so that's
so,
what I
was. So what was the name? What was the name of this festival in Africa?
It was FESTAC, the second Black and African Festival of Arts.
Do they still have it?
They had one last year, Festival of Arts, that was in Senegal. You know, they had one there, but this was the third one. You know, so you see how much longer in between that these festivals have been happening. So the first one was in 65 in Senegal, you know. Then they had the second one in Nigeria in 77. And then, you know, just last year they had another one in Senegal again. But, you know, it's far and few. And, you know, it's a problem because all of the footage and films that had been, people came from all over the world and they shot all of these films. But you never get a chance to see these films. So our children are not inspired by these films of incredible dancing, of incredible movement, of incredible part of our history that relates. So when you see those movements and you see how it relates to who you are, you know, and then be able to identify those movements as a part of your particular culture, you know. Or,
last night I happened to be watching TV and I was watching Beyonce. And there was a story about Beyonce that she had done. And she actually brought a couple of dancers from Africa who had made some unique dance moves. And she actually brought these two dancers from Africa to teach them how to do these dance moves that she incorporated into one of her performances.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, yeah, well, you know,
I mean,
all of the dances
that they have here in the United States, she was able to find something that was so unique with the African movement, African dance movement, that she couldn't get it duplicated here in the United States. She had to actually bring them from Africa over here to actually teach other people how to do it.
Well, I mean, there are some movements that, you know, we haven't studied, but we have probably, I mean, the language, the movement in language is part of our vocabulary, is a part of our DNA, you know. So there's probably no movements really that hasn't been already duplicated, you know, as part of the language. Now, if you want it to be done precisely in a particular way on the kind of level that Beyonce has the money to afford, you know, to get that kind of excitement, you know. Maybe you might need to go specifically for, the Mandinka.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? You know, so it's part of what she wants to create. Now, that all of those pop movies that you do, you see in Nigeria, you see in Senegal, you see in the Gambia, you know, all of those movements, you know, all those butt movements and stuff that she does, everything that she does is already, you know, is traditional. All of that stuff is traditional, you know.
Right.
And it comes out, you know, and she knows that. She has been studying African dance as well. You know, she studies all the different dances. I love her for that, you know.
Right.
She's wonderful like that, you know. She's, you know.
Let me ask you. You know, you say that you after you came back from Africa, you came back here to America to study the African American, the way that the African Americans dance. What was it that you started to study?
Well, because I had a chance to see everybody. You know, I lived in the village of Festac. You know. So I was able to see all the different movements. And what I'd seen was the movements that was from my hometown. I was born in Charleston, South Carolina. So I seen the movement in my community, you know, there. You know, when I came to New York, I was 7, you know. But there was a place down south, Mosquito Beach and, you know, in Charleston, you know, James Island, you know, where I'm from, you know. And, you know, all of those movements was done there, you know. And when I moved to Harlem, in Harlem, we did all of those movements that I'd seen. As a matter of fact, everybody who the people that I seen there looked like all the people that I see throughout Harlem. So, you know, that was just so beautiful to me because I seen my family. I seen my auntie. I seen my Aunt Bernice. I seen everybody, you know, that was part of my family. So naturally, I wanted to learn our African-American dances so the next time I would go, I would be able to share in that experience. I would be able
right.
to show them, the counterparts to the continuation of the dances that I've seen, you know. So that was my study. That was the reason why I studied as hard as I do, and that's why I, try to understand the history behind it and of the movements and all. And that's why I do lecture demonstrations and workshops, residencies in the school.
Did you ever participate in the Museum of Natural History Dance Festival?
Oh, yeah, dance, yeah, of course. I worked at the museum every year, just about every year for it has turned over to a new group now. So, you know, the groups that are dealing now. Well, you have Community Works that's doing the Kwanzaa program and the Black History program. But before that, I used to work there all the time. You know,
what was the purpose, intention? What was the purpose? What was the intention? And because I believe I remember you doing some stilt dancing there. Is that correct?
Oh yes, I've studied. Like when I was in Nigeria, I seen the stilt, the stilt walkers, the Igunico. I seen a lot of different masks. You know, I seen the.
Let me ask you this: for people that are listening. Well, could you just mm-hmm. give a visual description of what stilt walking is?
Well, I mean, stilt walking is the name of the group is Message from Our Ancestors, you know, and that's what the group, that's what the mass represents, an ancestor, you know, and so you know, it's a very tall mask, you know, and it's in full costume and, you know, headpiece and the face is covered. Actually, you don't see who it is. You don't know who it is, a part of a secret society. So I normally don't talk about that, you know. And people usually don't know me from that because I'm always covered totally. So they don't know and see my face to it, you know. But, you know, that's a part of a secret society and different communities that mean certain things, different things, you know. So if you deal with the Dogon, you know, and you see the Dogon people, you know, they have the stilts, but they have the bird face, you know, and a crocodile top, you know, so as above, so below, you know. So they believe, you know, that if you went across the, that they lived cliff dwellers because they wanted to be closer to God. So they used the crocodile to go across the river, you know, to go into the mountains so that the bird would send the messages to God, you know, just part of, you know, I'm just paraphrasing now because, you know, lack of time. But, you know,
yeah.
That's, so you see, you know, the emblem of the bird, you know, you see the emblem of the crocodile piece that they put on, which is like a white piece, as above, so below. Just like the crocodile feet is up and the other part is down, that's what they represent, you know. So then other people, you know, in different areas, the farmers, you know, they will use it to look over the land, over the vegetation, you know, which is, becomes high, you know, and they use it in that manner to maybe to even scare or other animals or things that would mess up into the crop. And
so they would use stilt walking to do those things?
Say, excuse me?
You said that they would use stilt walking in order to, you know, look over the
They would, because the crops was high, and so they walked through, and also it would be to frighten, birds and, you know, stuff that would eat their crops, too, you know. So it has so many different, it's important to where you are, you know, it's how they use the masquerade, different ways that this masquerade is used. You know, I mean, whatever gives you life, you know, whatever helps you exist in this world, in this life, you know, is what you pay tribute to, you know. So if you live near the sea, you know, you may make harvest of the sea, you know. and you appreciate the fish and all that from the sea. So you make movements and talk about, you know, the harvesting of the sea. So if you're inland, you may make movement that turn the soil or put the seeds onto the earth and all of that, you know, so make movements and talk about, you know, the gathering of the vegetation, you know, that gives you, you know, your sustenance, you know. So if you're in the forest area, you may, you know, so you maybe shoot your bow and arrow or a spear or whatever to, you know, to capture animals and eat like that, you know, or the movement or even just picking up and just gathering. You know, movements or kicking movements, you know, those are all our movements that talk about who we are as a people and where we come from and our direction, you know, and so what give us life and our sustain our existence, you know. So dance has always been that. So we work in that, you know, to make sure, you know, that is happening. Can you hear me?
Yes, I definitely can hear you. I'm just following some of the things that you're basically saying.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought my phone had cut off.
No, yeah, you're good. So, you're very good. What I wanted to ask you was, you know, after getting into dance, what not only are you dancing, you know, at the Museum of Natural History and doing the silk dances, but what are some of the other some of the other things that you have been able to get into, some of the other productions that you've been a part of?
Oh man, it's been so many things. I am extremely proud of being a part of Dance Black America. You know, Dance Black America was initiated at the Brooklyn Academy of Music. You know, and Lenwood Sloan and Nikki Shepherd, you know, produced it. And we had toured all through this country, you know, so that was the history. We first did it, you know, using major companies like Alvin Ailey's Dance Company, Goff's Dance Company, Charles Moore's Dance Company, Mama Lou Park's Dance Company, Charles Moore's, I mentioned. Yeah, quite a few, and international, part of International African American Ballet, the company that I came out of. I came out of the International African American Ballet. After I left Chuck, I had worked with International for like 20 years. But
wow.
But I'm extremely proud of the that work that I've done with the International African American Ballet.
Now,
but,
what
you know,
year was that you actually participated in the International Black Ballet?
When I got back from Nigeria in 77, I seen that company for the first time, you know. And then the 78, I seen that company, and I said, wow, unbelievable, you know. And I went upstage, you know, and for some reason I told them that I was going to be working. They were at the Lafayette Theater on 137th Street, you know, right where you know, on the Abyssinia on the other side, that Lafayette Theater, it's the old, you know, Lafayette Theater that was there. But they were performing there, and I went to see them. And I seen they were doing the silk there. And the brother Olupishe Wiles was doing, you know, was dancing. And all of the sisters and brothers from International was there. Amani A. Payne, Rhonda Mormon, you know, I mean, master drummers and, you know... You know, I mean, we're drumming just like I had seen in Africa. It was so pure, the work that they were doing. And so I had told them that I was going to work with them, you know, and they kind of laughed at me, you know. And then again, about a year, about 6 months later, I seen them again at the Clipboard Auditorium. And they just did all the work that I seen in Senegal, the Saba, Olosodone, Jondone, Kakilambe. You know, and they had a stilt walker there, you know. So I went back up on stage and told them that I was going to be working with them. That was bold and crazy, but that's what I felt in my heart, that I was going to be with them, because I knew I needed to be with them, you know. And Brother John Blanchford came and said to me, well, if you want to, you know, you want to work with us, you know, I'm starting a workshop for the men all the way on Farmingdale Avenue, way out in Queens, you know, if you can make it out there on Wednesdays, you know, you can be, you know, we can work, you know. So
right.
I got out there, there were three other brothers there, and we did that, you know. And so, and then eventually I started working with the company, and we did our first Dance Africa in 80, 78. In 78, we did the first, and we just celebrated the Dance Africa 78, last summer, in May, So all of the companies who started Dance Africa was a part of the first initial Dance Africa in 78. We just celebrated that, So that was a wonderful thing that just happened. But a lot of people missed it, I think, But
well,
I did the last year, too. I did the last year last year also for Dance Africa.
Well, that's interesting history. I mean, so you told us about how you actually started and some of the things that you. When did you start? You said that you've worked with the International Black Ballet for about 20 years, but when did you start actually doing choreography?
Oh, I was doing that because I eventually started my own company, The Message from My Ancestors, Lucashay had the name first, and I told him, I said, Lucashay, let's do this, And so even though we were working with International, we had a little separate group of masquerades and stoke walkers, that we did for the Museum of Natural History, Lincoln Center, Caribbean Cultural Center. We did the Coca-Cola Centennial in Atlanta, Georgia, Chicago. We were traveling and flying all over doing the stilts and festivals all through this country, And we were also doing a lot of work with Baba Ashange, And that was my other father, brother, and we did Baba Ashange. We did a lot of different works all over throughout the country. So that was,
It says here, I'm looking at Circuit Productions Incorporated, and it says that Clyde Wilder was a dance consultant to choreographer Diane McIntyre on the film Beloved, has performed with John Hendrick, the Count Basie Orchestra, and Stevie Wonder. He has appeared on Dance in America on PBS, National Geographic, Jitterbug, and the Smithsonian Institution Stomping at the Savoy. How did you, and
Stomping
I know that
the
you,
Smithsonian.
How did you get in that? Why was the Smithsonian and National Geographic, why were they interested in Jitterbug and Stomping at the Savoy? Why was there such an interest in that coming from these institutions?
Well, the Smithsonian Institute had $225 million grant that they were building a whole building, there at the Smithsonian Institute for jazz, and they incorporated for jazz, and so they wanted to include the dance along with it. So at that time, I was working with Frankie Manning and Norma Miller. I worked with Norma Miller from 80. We still work and we still do things together. We still come together and do different projects, Norma Miller is one of the original Whitey's Lindy Hopper, So I got a chance to work with John Hendricks and Red Fox. We used to do the Red Fox tour. I did a lot of stuff I didn't even put on here, But stuff that we did, I toured with Red Fox also. We would go to Playboy Club and hit all the prisons upstate and all, And John Hendricks would be with us and Annie Ross and of course Norma Miller and Frankie. We all did the show, and it was just great. We would do a wonderful thing. But the Institute Smithsonian had they got four musicians from each major group, to be archived there. So they brought that program together, and that's what we did. We danced there, and they filmed us. I mean, they archived every little single thing that we did. It was like 30 cameras everywhere on us, So it's archived at the Smithsonian Institute with Frankie Manning, Norma Miller, and Norma Miller jazz dancers. And at that time, Frankie's son, Chaz Young, Debbie Williams, Amani A. Payne, and Scobie and Darlene Getz, And if you look at Norma Miller's book, Swinging at the Savoy, that's the picture those are the pictures with Red Fox, and those are the pictures, you know.
I'm really glad we have you on, Clyde, because you're throwing out names that, you know, I don't even recognize, but it's obvious that these are names that are very important to the history of dance, and it's very important that I'm really glad you did this program, because this gives people who are listening an opportunity to actually do the research on some of these people and to, you know, come to understand the contributions that yourself and many of these people have actually made to dance in the American circumstance.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there was something else that I just want everybody to know that we're speaking with Clyde Wilder, who is an established, whose resume is wide, and he says he's part of the Harlem Swingers. He's a well-established director, choreographer, and dancer. He is the artistic director of Message from Our Ancestors, a traditional West African ensemble featuring secret society stilt walkers and a phenomenally talented core of versatile performers. He has captured the vocabulary of American vernacular dance from its traditional influence and origin on African dance. Now, what does that mean? He has captured the vocabulary of African vernacular dance. Can you explain that to us and give us some ideas about that?
Right. So what I'm saying is that you, as I came back from Nigeria and learned a whole lot of different traditional steps, I have also been studying our African American dance. And our African, see, our Lindy Hop contains so many movements of our traditional vernacular movements. You know, I'm talking about, you know, I do the traditional movements from West Africa, and I draw those continuation of those movements like Wolosodon, Jondon, and I understand the comparison, the continuation of those movements as to the plantation dance and the movements of that. Dances like the Big Apple, dances like the Charleston, you know, how those relate to Wolosodon, how they relate to the Charleston, you know, how the Charleston relate to Wolosodon, how the Saba relate to the blues, you know, the continuation, how the different buck dances, you know, relate to all of them, how those movements and for the reason why, you know, those movements were continued, how the cakewalk, you know, segue, you know, into different parts of the Charleston, you know, all of that, you know, all of that, into the Black Bottom and all of that. Those are the things that I studied and been studying and still studying, you know. But fortunately, I was able to work with Norma Miller and Frankie Manning. Norma Miller and Frankie Manning was the original Whitey's Lindy Hoppers. Whitey's Lindy Hoppers was the group that was at the Savoy Ballroom. So if you've seen old footage of Day at the Races, Hells a Poppin', and Day at the Races, Hells a Poppin', and all a lot of different old films, you would see Norma Miller and Frankie Manning in. You would see, if you studied Murray Dane's film, The Spirit Move, you would see Norma Miller, you would see Frankie Manning, and, you would see Al Mims and Leon James, and Scobie Strumman, so many different people, you know, that we should know, we should know all of these people, because this is the essence of our traditional African American dances, you know. These people carry those movements. They're the vernacular. They are the tap dancers. They're the hoofers. They're the they're the continuation from Bojangles and before that, you know. They are the continuation of, you know, from the straight from the plantation, straight to the next generation. That's who they are, and that's who I've been surrounding myself with. Honey Coles and Cookie Cook and Buster Brown and all of those guys. You know, I've worked with them. I've break bread with them. I've gone on all of the bus tours that they had, not bus tours, but the boat rides, and the, you know, because I lived in Harlem. You know, I went to all of the dances that they used to give. They had a group, the Copacetics had a group that was over 100 strong, and they were called, you know, was 100 strong, and they were at the Hoofers Club, you know, and what they did was they formed a fraternity of guys
who had such a strong thing. They all helped each other and passed, helped each other to achieve, you know. And, you know, if whatever was needed, they helped and contributed to that. So they gave dances, they gave bus rides and boat rides, they gave all kinds of programs, you know, that helped our community and survive the whatever was going on. We had a community of people who kept the culture in sync, you know. And
yes,
that's who they were. They were a powerful group. Mm-hmm.
You know, it says here about Whitey's Lindy Hoppers that Whitey's Lindy Hoppers was the brainchild of Herbert Whitey White, an African-American man known as Whitey because of the streak of whiteness here. He was a former boxer who became a bouncer at the Savoy Ballroom.
Yes.
At one time, more than 70 swing dancers were employed by Whitey. He had a good eye for talent and a good coach. He knew how to nurture. He gave many future entertainers their start in show business. It also says that in the early 30s, as word got around about the sensational swing dancing at the Savoy Ballroom, requests came from downtown socialites and rich folks who wanted to have Lindy Hoppers perform at their lavish parties. Whitey, who got to be known as the young dancer as well, was able to handpick exciting dancers who were also socially adept and reliable. Some of the films that they were involved in was Day at the Races, Hell's the Poppin', Manhattan Merry-Go-Round, Radio City Rebel, Big Apple, also known as the Jittering Jitterbug in 1937, which is a short film, and Hot Chocolate, which is Cottontail, also a 1942 soundie, which was very interesting. This is all part of the history that our brother's talking about. Yes, go ahead, brother.
In 1939, they were also at the World's Fair. The World's Fair that was in Queens over here, you know.
Yes.
They built a pavilion, you know, that housed the Lindy Hoppers. See, they were our movie stars, you know. They were, you know, our first, like, dance movie stars. I mean, except for Catherine Dunham, you know, because, you know, you've seen Stormy Weather, you know. But, you know, but they were in quite a few movies, you know. And, Frankie Manning was a major choreographer that got a Tony, you know, for Black and Blue, you know, also, you know. But Frankie has traveled all throughout the world, you know, and presented, you know.
I see Frankie Mann as the dancer.
Until the day he died.
Some of the people that you've mentioned, you know, Frankie Manning, Norma Miller, Al Mind, Milton Pillard, Billy Ricker, Willa Mae Ricker, Russell Williams. These are some of the people that you've mentioned.
Right. They were Al Mims, you know, was a friend of mine too. You know, Billy Richter. I used to go to his house and be, you know, and sit and talk and, you know, and chat with him all the time. Matter of fact, the fact that he came to see my show at Symphony Space. I was on the stilts. I was performing on the stilts there, and oh my God, just to, you know, to have him see that, you know, and Frankie was there too, you know, to have him see, you know, me performing and doing my thing, you know. You know, doing the African and African American, so we had a chance to talk all the time, you know, about our vernacular dances and movements, you know. So those are the people that, you know, I was quite impressed with, you know, and, you know, and you know, studied from, and all the different films that I was able to, you know, there's only a few films that you're able to see, you know, that's readily available in our community that we could, you know. You don't get a chance to see. But, you know, and that's bad, you know, because our children are not inspired by, you know, the film, you know, of our elders, you know. See, Michael Jackson had a star in California and Hollywood, you know. He had, you know, John Bubbles right there, you know. John Bubbles was there. They had a hoopers club out there in California, too, where all the guys got together and did hooping and dancing and all. So, you know, so they were able, he had access to the Bubbles, you know.
What place did Sammy Davis Jr. and his uncles have? What were they called?
Because
Davis Jr. used to work with his uncles, right?
I'm not sure about working with his uncle. I don't remember Sammy from that. you know, Hines. I know, but the Hines brothers used to work with Hines, Hines and Dad. You know,
yes,
Hines,
yes.
Hines and Dad. You know,
yeah,
yeah. Gregory and Maurice. You know, I mean,
right.
You know, they became the late Hoopers. I mean, you know, part of the copacetics. You know, they were the latest ones. You know, the last ones I think to come as part of the copacetics. Because they used to come off to the dance at Manhattan Center.
It was called the Will Maskin Trio.
Will Maskin Trio? Oh, okay.
Yeah,
I wasn't sure.
Where Sammy used to work with his uncles. It was his uncles, and they would feature, and Sammy Davis Jr. was featured on it. It was so, I mean, to see some of the dances that he was doing, man, was really something.
Oh.
As a matter of fact, I'm looking at it right now.
Sammy was
on,
incredible.
Yeah,
Norma
Sammy
Miller,
Davis Jr., Boogie Woogie.
Mm-hmm. Norma Miller used to talk about Sammy, how wonderful Sammy was, you know, Sammy Davis Jr. was, you know, all the time, just how incredible. He wanted to be Mr. Entertainer. So whatever he did, you know, I mean, he can play the trumpet better than anybody. He could play the
Sammy?
Saxophone better than anybody.
Wow.
Sammy! He could drum better than anybody. He could tap dance better than anybody. He could sing better than anybody. He could act better than anybody. He wanted to be Mr. Entertainer. He wanted to be the best, and he worked hard at it. And he was excellent at everything that he did, you know. He did a lot of incredible things, you know. And, yeah, and so I think Sammy it was three people that had the same birthday that was incredible. John Hendricks, I think, and Sammy. Because my son... You know, we did the show, I did the show with Norm, we did the show at the Village Gate, you know, which John Hendricks came and sang, and I brought my son doing the rehearsals back then, you know, and I told John Hendricks, you know, he loved my son Kwame because my son was just, you know, I mean, extreme like he is. He's very, very, you know, he's in the 99th percentile and very sharp on things, and, you know, and he had the same birth date as, you know, John Hendricks, which was
yeah,
they really picked up on each other.
But,
So now, Clyde, today,
Clyde, we only have a few minutes left in the program. But what I wanted to, you know, you've given us a lot of history, and I really appreciate that. But what are some of the things that you are doing today as far as dance is concerned? What are you doing today with dance?
Well, I'm still teaching at Black River Studio, 345 Lenox Avenue. I'm there at 8 o'clock, you know, on Monday night, and I'll be there this Monday, you know. But I'm teaching there, and I also do some workshops and stuff with Art Horizon, you know. I do residency. Yeah, but, so you know, but the economy is kind of bad, so it's not. I don't get as many as I used to. Sometimes I do some work with Community Works, you know, so they call me far and few, you know. So, but some museums, the Brooklyn Children's Museum last year, I did some things out there, you know. I travel and I do the Gullah stuff. I still go down for the Gullah Festival in Beaufort, South Carolina, you know. And I do, I do the silks and I do some workshops and stuff, so, you know, for the Gullah Festival. So,
Is dance still popular in America when we talk about, I'm not talking about modern dance, I'm talking about the dances of like Jitterbug and Swing, are they still popular in America?
Well, the young black people are into the hip-hop, you know, so they're under the spell about the hip-hop and, you know, and so that's what they're doing basically, you know. But,
been incorporated? Things like the Jitterbug and all that hasn't been incorporated into hip hop? What is it that these dances,
some people are trying to incorporate hip hop also into hip hop or some of the traditional jazz movements into the hip hop too. Some of them are already there. They just emphasizing them more. It's a lot of the movements, like I said, there's nothing that's pretty much new. You know, a lot of the movements are already there, but now they're emphasizing them a little bit more and trying to draw those parallels with them, you know.
Well, let me, another question that I wanted, But another question I wanted to ask you, and I think this is important, Clyde, and that is the drum. How important is the drum rhythm? Has the rhythm of the drum rhythm of hip hop is quite different. It's syncopatic. It's electrical. It's technological. Is it a long way from the drum beat of the conga and the African drum? And is that the reason why that dance has changed?
Well, it's not so much the it's the rhythmic beats. It's the rhythm, you know. It's the rhythm in dance that's important, you know. I don't think that's the reason. I think, you know, I think there's a commercial thing behind it. I don't think the movement is, I don't think the drumming, you know, the kind of drumming, because you got the same kind of beat, you know, traditional rhythm, you know. You got traditional rhythms in each dance, you know. You got, there's a bottom beat, you know, with the hip hop thing, you know. And see, I can't be a person to speak for hip hop because I don't really do hip hop, you know. But,
no, I know, but I know that rhythm is important. Rhythm is important to dance.
Yeah,
and
rhythm.
The way that these rhythms have come about right now as far as hip hop, with the DJ scratching and this technical drum beat, it seems, and that's why I asked you, you know, and I got what you're saying as far as the rhythm is concerned, that the rhythm mm-hmm. might be the same, but I just can't see you doing the African dance to this hip hop stuff. I mean, could you?
Well, I do. It's funny because when we, you know, even at the Black Art Festival in Atlanta and different places that we, you know, I mean, I swung out on traditional Lamba, Benjani. I swung out with my partner Amanie in Chicago. You know, back in the day, we used to swing out, you know, on Lamba or Benjani or Wolofodom, you know. I could swing to that 4-4-4-4 rhythm, you know. And it's the same thing. It's the same kind of spirit, you know. I could break into a Charleston on any of those rhythms. I could break into any of those things, you know, and do it. And I do, because, you know, I can break right and go right into salsa into any of those swing movements or any of those things, and then join right back out and swing right back out. I can do that, you know. So just like I can do that, they can do the same, you know. They can, the hip hop people can do the same if they, you know, if they understand the rhythm, you know. They can do the same. So it's not what's happening is you know, people have been drawn to, you know, these crazy lyrics, you know, that too, you know, they say, oh, I like the beat. Yeah, the beat is wonderful, and I could spit into any of the hip hop stuff. You know, I could swing. We could swing to the hip hop stuff, and I do. And I do that at parties just to show people that you can. You know, so that's not an issue. You know, I think personally, I think that people really have. You know, we like to add water and shake. You know, we want that instant gratification thing. You know, and we just want to add water and shake on that level. You know, but we have to understand how important this dance is to our lifestyle, our relationship, our communication, being able to touch, you know, being able to hold somebody in your arm and communicate real close, you know, and to feel the other person and really give to the other person. We have lost that sharing, giving, and exchanging the romance of each other. We want to be separated and apart and do our individual thing. You know, and do our self expression and not be able to share. Now I do salsa and merengue, bachata, cha-cha. I do all of it. You know, the partnering stuff. You know, the blues. You know, I teach the blues. Not too many people teach the blues, but I teach the blues as well. You know, and so I connect to all of these things. I mean, I have absolutely nothing against the hip hop doing the thing because it's physical. They are dancing, but you know when you start talking about these lyrics that is hurtful, you know, that demean and take you down physically when you start, you know, having an appearance, you know, that you look like a prisoner, like you look like a slave, you know, look like you captured, look like, you know, what's the difference between a slave and a prisoner, you know, when they're walking around, you know, with their butt out, you know, and can't move, can't even run, you know, or, you know, when a child is looking at a grown man with his pants down, you know, and who's to tell him, look, put your pants up so that, you know, so that you can walk at least, so that you won't hurt your body. You're taking your body out. You're walking like a duck. You're taking your whole body out of sequence. You're not in balance. You're not in you're not in balance with yourself. You know, you're taking yourself out of balance, and you know, and this is what you're teaching. You're teaching that to a whole group of people that eventually are going to be physically inept. You know, because you know. So I don't have a problem with these people making money. You know, they're making money, you know, with the clothing and all of this. But, you know, come on. You know, your appearance is just extremely important, you know.
Well,
and
I think thing that you – it seems like what you've also hit on is, like you said, add water and shake. You can't add water and shake if you don't do any research as far as history is concerned.
I was talking
with Charles Barron, a city councilman from Brooklyn, yesterday. And I asked him, why have you stayed focused on what you do as far as community is concerned when there's so many distractions out in the world? And he said it's because, you know, I have an appreciation for what our ancestors have tried to do historically as far as our people is concerned. And so, you know, this idea as far as history is very, very important. And many of the things that you have mentioned on this program today has given us some historical context to dance in America, and I'd like to say, brother, that you've made a contribution. And I know that this is not something that you probably started out, like I was saying at the beginning of the program. And, you know, it's not something that, you start out to do, but it is where you've ended up and you've been able to make a contribution. And so, you know, ending the program, what would you like to say about some of the things that you have done and what we should do as far as this is Black History Month and making the contribution to history?
Well, the first thing that anybody should do, anybody, you know, is to grab the elders in your family and record them, ask them, interview them. The elders of your family, interview the elders of your family. Ask them about everything. Ask them about their lifestyle. Ask them about what they've done. All of, you know, the dances that they've gone through, the places that they've gone through, the history of themselves, you know. You find that out. You know, when you find that out, you'll find out some important and some things that will be life-changing for you and be so powerful for you. That's what I've done with my high school students. I had them, taking them to senior citizen centers and asked them, you know, and had them interview different elders, and they told the different stories of their work. They told the stories. I mean, they said things that, you know, words and stuff that we don't even use now, you know. They talked about the coal, you know, the coal bin, you know. What's a coal bin? You know, we don't use coal bin, but those are the places that we used to climb down and play when we were kids, you know. When they came and brought the coal in to heat up the furnace, you know, for the building, you know. And, you know, stuff like that, you know. Just, I mean, there's so many different other things that you'll learn just from that. So, but I understand and I know that we have to understand that this dance, you know, is a part of our language. When they took our language away, we use dance as a form of communication. We use a form of our health, you know. So our health is, I mean, we've got diabetes and everything else now because we're not moving physically. We have to keep it moving. We have to keep moving and dance. Don't let them take the stuff out of school and then you don't do anything else with your children. Take the children to different dance programs and have them dance. And not just a regular dance program, but a dance program is going to give them some insight on who they are and where they come from, whether they came from the Caribbean or wherever, you know, what part of the Caribbean. Each of these places have a different way of that they dance. That belongs to their particular culture. The clothing they wear, the foods that they ate, all belongs to them. That's culture in the whole. So when you do that, you enforce an understanding of the perpetuation of yourself And so that's what you want to do: respect and perpetuate yourself when you ask people, your elders, questions about who they are and what they have been. Now we don't have a connection with that, with our elders. People don't respect, you know, with the elders. Now you hear on the news, people are robbing the elders and you know, treating them poorly. You know, when we should respect and sit at their feet and listen to the stories that they tell, because they will enhance your living today. You know, and mistakes that you made, you know, maybe you can avoid, you know, today, you know, from mistakes that was done, you know, before. So, you know, but this is, you know, this is what my enthusiasm.
Well, I appreciate
my help. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Clyde, listen, man, I appreciate, you know, I appreciate you coming on and speaking with us about, especially during this month of African-American history. And, you know, people make a big thing about, oh, you know, why we got to be African-American history, Black history. I remember at one time it was Black History Week, and now it's Black History Month. It's important to recognize these things. They say it's fictitious. They say that it's shallow to just recognize Black history. But, you know, look, we need to recognize.
Oh, that is so crazy to say that, you know. They wouldn't say that to, you know, other people. You know, they would say it to us. But, you know, it is very significant, you know. No, it is very significant that you know who you are, you know. And even the whole history of Black history, you know, Frederick Douglass and, you know, I mean, you know, the whole thing, you know,
right.
Done, you know, to right. All respect Frederick Douglass and Abraham Lincoln, you know, that's why it's in February to celebrate their month, you know, to celebrate
right.
That month, you know.
Yes.
But another important thing was, you know, we have to, you know, we use this just like we created, just like Kwanzaa was created, you know. To enhance our life, you know, to perpetuate our life, you know, and it, you know, and to, you know, and to give some sustainability to our existence, you know. When we are in trouble, we are in some major trouble in this economy and this lifestyle that we're living right now. So we have always, you know, had you know, all the groups that all the companies that performed, you know, and all the poets, you know, spoke, and they did history, and they, you know, talk about self-development, self-improvement, self-generating businesses, and all these other helpful process, you know. Well, that's what we did, you know, to sustain ourselves, because not just so many things was coming at us, you know, the business world was coming at us, you know, certain parts of the religion was coming at us.
Yeah, and I would like to continue, but I only got 90 seconds to go. But Clyde, again, I know, brother.
No, thank you, brother Kareem. Thank you for having me on. I totally appreciate you having me on, and hopefully maybe we can do this again sometime, and we can talk about you know, actual specific. I know I generate, you know, kind of far.
We will do that. Okay.
Okay.
All right, take care, brother.
All right, thank you. God bless you.
Okay.
And yeah, salam alaikum, brother.
Hey, listen, brothers and sisters, we're running out of time. I only got 60 seconds left, but I hope that you enjoyed this as much as I did. I would like to thank Nuri Amir for coming on Harlem Getaways, and also my brother, Clyde Wilder from Harlem Swingers, who shared with us some of the dance history of America. And tune in next week when we'll have Tavia Taylor on, and some others. Sam, my brother Sam, who's going to give us some more on African history. We'll really go into African history next week. And so with that, what I'm going to do is I'm going to end this show by saying assalamu alaikum until next week. William Kareem signing off.
Thank you for listening to this week's edition of Meet the Members of the Muslim American Media Alliance. Stay tuned and up to date on the activities of our members and media by visiting us on Facebook under Muslim American Media Alliance. And until next week's edition, when we publish the perspective of another Muslim in media, this is your host, William Kareem, signing off.
Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.